Chapter 13. Rebirth. Laura had been pregnant for so long that any other state seemed inconceivable. I watched the house fill with subtle signs of a new arrival, a pram, tiny clothes, and I myself participated in the painting of the baby's room, but it all seemed like an abstract and ceremonial exercise. Something we were doing as a blind ritual of appeasement. I looked at the robust and ridiculous pram in the hallway and said to Laura, "But where will we go? When would we ever need such an object?" She did not enjoy the line, and in fact became annoyed. I just couldn't think what use a pram would be. I don't know why the world persists with the idea that a pregnancy lasts 9 months either, when it plainly lasts for 10, and by the end of the 9th the waddling goddess does little but beseech the tardy heavens for delivery of this inconceivable cargo. Quietly I said my own prayer. I asked for preparedness, knowing all was about to change but not knowing how. The change from not having a baby to having a baby is too radical to be taken in one almighty leap. It should be handled in instalments like those magazines where each edition is accompanied by a further piece of the Cutty Sark or a Spitfire. Issue 1, 99p. I hope the second issue isn't a fiver. The baby should arrive 1 foot at a time. An ankle independently issued, then a finger or an ear, the mouth last. If I can take care of this leg successfully, like a girl at an inner-city comp lugging around a bag of leaking and battered sugar, then I can take the rest of the infant in a few months. Instead, the whole incredible bounty arrives in one opera of glorious revelation. 3 a.m., Friday the 4th, November 2016. "Russell," says a voice through the silence and the stillness. I think it started. I know, of course, that this is a signal of commencement, a call to arms. The starting pistol has been fired, but as a prospective father, I do not know what manner of race is to follow or where the finishing line might be. When we awaited the result of the 7-week scan, I relayed my concern to a friend. "What if there's something wrong?" "Even if there isn't," she said, "then you have the 12-week scan, the 36-week scan, the birth, the childhood, the adolescence. You're a hostage to fortune now." I've been awake since midnight. The contractions, or surges, are 8 minutes apart. We call them surges, when we remember, as the medical language around childbirth is negative and unhelpful. We learned on a course called hypnobirthing, which may as well have been called hippie birthing, because that's what it is. I get up and I think put the kettle on and move some towels around, having some semi-conscious recollection that this is what the situation demands. What I sense, though, on the periphery of my awareness, is that a greater force is about to be asserted, reducing all of our human activity to ornamental incidentals. We use an app, of course, to measure the contractions in the half-light of our bedroom. I take this extremely seriously, as it's the only job I have. I try to press the timer at the exact moment that Laura says, "Appy," the regrettable safe word we agreed for a contraction, sorry, surge, commencement. Our cats move to the pinnacle of their individual characters. Morrissey, in his high street tux, stands impassive and intense, a centurion of our tiny kingdom. Jericho, all Bengal exoticism, flits and leaps and asserts light-footed diagonal scrambles across this newly sacred space. Downstairs, the bear, the big brown Alsatian, sighs. This time moves most magically. Laura seeking out new places to stand and breathe and fall within. Me observing and dreaming up duties and wondering which particular sound might signal a need for departure or any kind of action. They, the midwives, tell you that when the contraction, sorry fuck, surges are 1 minute in duration and 3 take place in a 10-minute period, it's time to go to the hospital. The app, or appy, though, doesn't see it that way. After every surge meticulously tapped in by me, a message pops up on screen. "Time to go to hospital." Of course, our bags are packed for the trip, snacks and blankets and laminated pages of high-minded instruction. The problem, though, is that the difference between a drill and the reality is always so distinct as to render all but the best preparation useless. The bags lie dormant in the spare room like a sepia postcard from another man. The other man was me in the past, and me who had only hypothetical challenges, whereas this man, me now, has to contend with the universal great challenge. I put the bags in the car, which I'd filled with petrol some days earlier. How can the mundanity of preparation ever truly steal us from the drama of the event? Our rituals must call to mind a deeper truth. They must be a portal to the future and the past, a connection. No time to think about all that now, though. I have to get back upstairs and tend to Laura, who is, I believe the technical term is, from the carol away in a manger, lowing, as in the cattle are. It is this intervention of a greater, previously concealed nature which provides much of the substance for the remainder of the labour. Laura, my serene, kind and thoughtful girlfriend who supports and takes care of me with such grace, is becoming a mammalian hulk, an animal, a goddess, and very definitely the epicentre of this situation, and if I may be so bold, of life itself. Because ultimately, what else is there? I call the midwife. It's 6:30 a.m. now. She grapples snoozily with the phone, and I can hear pillows and half-light in her voice. Laura's having contractions, I say. Surges, she corrects. How far apart are they? They're between 4 and 6 minutes apart. We are instructed to call later. In our room, the magical intimacy remains. Real specialness, not like the BAFTAs or a John Lewis advert, but a daunting sense of impending wonder. It is in the synthesis of the physical and divine that I find myself frozen in astonishment. This is plainly about the body, about pain and muscle and groaning and blood and dilation. What, though, is this secondary element, this sense of being held, guided, carried, if not by a metaphysical grace, then by the pathway already walked by all of our ancestors? This is the path in essence from unlife to life. After a few more meticulously observed and diligently timed hours of lowing and leaning, an occasional gentle exclamation, and one ill-advised attempt at yogic chanting by me, obviously, we summon the midwife, Karina, a South African. Apparently this is mandatory, and she arrives and is pretty cool. Towels do seem to be necessary, it's not just a cliche. More necessary, in fact, than a male presence, so somewhat crestfallen, I go for a run with the dog. There's a good deal of politics in the childbirth world, did you know that? There is a plausible feminist theory that childbirth has become unduly medicalized in order to transfer the power of the process from women to men, from nature to technology. We learned a lot about this over the pregnancy, hence words like surge instead of contraction, terms like special circumstance instead of complications. Some of it seems a bit hippie, even for me as a bloke with Hindu symbols tattooed on my arm. Other aspects, like giving birth on all fours, not on your back, in darkness, not under an intrusive medical light, and in your own time, not at the behest of an obstetrician's schedule, all seem spot on to me. The role of the male in all this is, of course, secondary, and I, due, I suppose, to love and the transcendent magnitude of the situation, find in myself the inverse of Laura's potent warrior life portal, a kind of gentle silver service butler bloke whispering and popping off to get ointments. Not far into the run, I check my phone, and Laura has called to say come back. The process has sped up, and once I've clomped back through the fields with breathless portent, I return to the bedroom, and Laura is indeed on all fours, waters broken, or realised, released, actually, and the whole place has that kind of moment after a fire alarm or bomb scare atmosphere of studied calm. Karina says we should leave now or have the baby in our bedroom, which I'm totally down with, but Laura's the boss, so off we go. her couched up in the back next to the currently vacant baby seat, mooing, crowing and all sorts in a beautifully unself-conscious way. I sit up the front, chauffeuring us through the country lane, sometimes having to go real slow when Laura surges, trying to work out how I feel about the midwife being in the car because I'm kind of touchy about strangers. We get to the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford and go via the giant aluminium lift pasted with posters of local events and activities for the staff to do while Laura leans and moans and different orderlies and nurses and other people who see this sort of stuff every day just go about their business. And I feel protective, like I want to wall her in. It's odd to feel protective when there's probably nothing to protect someone from. You're kind of being protective in a bubble. It's an evolutionary anachronism. I feel like a kangaroo or iguana making some once vital move now redundant in the busy, lumbering lift. We get to our floor, the 7th, and buzz for entry to the midwife centre, and I feel self-conscious about Karina, like we've brought our own bourgeois mechanic into a quick fit. The indigenous midwives eye our interloper like alley cats. We're taken to an assessment room and Laura, who is super no-nonsense and irritable at this point, gives short shrift to Marie, the Latina midwife who wants to check her out. We left the house because Karina said Laura was 3 centimetres dilated. This, Marie on inspection, disputes and it feels a bit like a courtroom drama where the vying sides call independent experts to validate their positions.
It's subjective, says Marie. We all have different sized fingers.
It is about 11 a.m. and she tells us she'll be back to check on us at about 4:30 p.m. as she leaves. Karina clearly feels like she shot her load a bit early by bringing us in, and Laura and I are both disappointed that the ceremonial and mysterious atmosphere of our room has been replaced now with the sterile and pragmatic plainness of the hospital. I also feel aggrieved at the loss of intimacy and the supplanting of the natural with the bureaucratic, and I think Laura feels the same, but of course her vocabulary is severely stunted by the groans every few minutes and the agricultural gloom she now displays. Karina goes to the hospital shop and leaves Laura and me together. I am, I'll admit, a little sulky at this point. I'm desperately trying to wrench my head out of self-centred irritability and into my necessary role as supporter and protector, but I just feel really pissed off that we've driven away from Eden to come to what feels like a kind of barren and inferior environment. I feel like we stopped listening to our instincts, our higher selves, in this instance a rare fusion of animal and angel, and instead subjugate ourselves to procedure, and now we are being punished. If you trust in God, God will carry you. If you abandon God, you are on your own. I feel alone and disconnected and am trying desperately to retune myself, to refocus on the woman on the bed, going through her first labour. I reach into the bag for the laminates. They contain a script for me, written by Laura, in anticipation of this moment, the moment when we are in the early part of labour and unclear of what to do, and I revert to type. Insular, lost in self. What I'm evidently meant to be doing is coaching Laura through her breathing and keeping us connected and in the present. Thank God for these scripts, I think, and throw myself into character. My solipsistic and neurotic fears focus on something being wrong with the baby, ranging from stillborn to birthmark. I shuffle through the endless deck of potential disasters that could befall me. Replace fear with faith, a friend of mine told me when I'd mentioned it to him. I do this now and am soothed. Laura, through the groans and after an impromptu and again very animal shower, like when Greenpeace workers douse a beached dolphin, tells me to WhatsApp her friends and the prospective grandparents. I do this. I send pictures and succinct social media style aphorisms. Laura is possessed. Not by an external entity, but by her truer nature. She is possessed by the person she needs to become, a mother. Finally, we're invited to choose another room to move to. Marie has decided, based on the quality, cadence, or something of the sounds that Laura is making, that it's time to decamp and asks which room we'd like to water birth in. Laura decrees from her hands and her knees on the gurney that we will have the windowless room, and we waddle off through some tarpaulin membrane across the corridor. Evidently work is being done, and this adds to the feeling of transition. Once in the birthing room with its pool, which is a big bath, its rolling purple, pink and blue lighting and cavernous, intimate solitude, things start to improve. I now have a few jobs. I can fetch things, yes, but also I'm monitoring the lighting, turning off all but the psychedelic swirl. Laura, encouraged by the change of scene, goes into a new, more intense and focused mode. Karina is now a comforting and reassuring female companion, and there are fewer skirmishes between the Jet and Shark midwife gangs, just one actually, about turning the tap on. Marie is territorial. Labour is defined by nature. Nature is near. Nature is with us all. Laura is its central deity, moaning, roaring, birthing, and we, the secondary caste, reach unwittingly into our own deeper selves. The women are more experienced and vie for matriarchal dominance. I, the lone male and innocent, prowl and wait and serve. I've been relieved of the self-centeredness of the previous hours in the previous space and can now feel the rhythm of the drama. The beat behind the skin and voices is asserting itself. The pulse, the life, is seeking its dominion. Laura moves into the water, lit like a Hendrix album. On all fours again she pushes, and I watch aquatic roses of blood gently bloom behind her. This excites me, but Marie checks Laura's dilation and says she's only 5 centimetres and we must be 10 centimetres before pushing can begin or Laura will hemorrhage. Although this seems serious and there is much talk of Laura's blood group, and insanely samples are taken even during contractions, I feel now that we're going to be all right. The beat is louder now. Something else is present. Here I see the power of Marie, the unshakable certainty of a veteran. Laura, when you want to push, you take the gas and air. You inhale and you exhale into the tube. You do not push. Very important, you do not push. Do you understand? Laura, naked and perfect, does understand. It's maybe 4 p.m. and the contractions are more frequent and one comes on now and I pass the gas and air and she falls into it. I watch enviously as Laura levitates. After the first blast, she becomes yet more holy, inhibitions exhaled, a sense of immersion and self-realization of which, along with the free buzz she's inhaling, I'm quietly envious of. These women know what they're doing, I think, as I resume my job as an orderly. Marie especially is totemic in her efficiency. These women live in proximity to drama, to life and birth and death. She had battlefield calm. I feel the irritation I always have when I sense I'm near incompetence dissipate. She is in and out of the room incessantly, and now and then you hear women scream and babies cry, and dramatic though it remains secondary, a scoring to the central events of our private and personal theatre. Laura swirls in the water and sound, and they all become as one another. Nature is but one thing. Divinity is in connectedness. An hour or two of this don't push business, and Laura asks Marie, "When can I push?" "When it is totally irresistible, when you can't not push." "I think it's irresistible now." I observe this perched at the poolside, holding the gas and air, occasionally pouring water on Laura's glistening form. "Can you feel inside yourself?" says Marie. "Put a finger inside yourself and tell me what you can feel." "I can't reach very far," she says. "There's something there." Then Marie, with a gentle, perfect, only just perceptible smile. "Something solid with hair?" Odd that given the context, Laura genuinely doesn't seem to immediately equate this presence with the emerging head. "Yes," she says, "I can only reach my finger into here," and she indicates the first knuckle, just after the nail on her index finger. "Laura," says Marie quietly, but with a kind of entirely new but somehow familiar wisdom, "now you can push." A contraction duly arrives. Laura pushes and roars, screams and contorts her face. Amazingly, she doesn't swear but uses Enid Blyton curse words like golly and gosh, and a melodic and beautiful wailing. It is like a siren song. Here she is in water, crying out in primal pain with harmony, harmony with herself, with the sound, with birth. Marie and Karina have now put aside their minor tribal differences and join the harmony. They move round her, supporting her position, counselling. I am kind of at a spiritual and primal football match. I have none of Laura's syntactic restraint and am vacillating between fucking hell, go on, Laura, and long gut-felt ohms. Laura wants to be in a different position. The contractions, surges, fuck surges, are near constant now. She swishes about in the pool on all fours, on her back, then finally squatting like a frog on her toes, heels up, knees outwards, and we lock at the eyes and the forearms. Laura here dives within herself entirely, as clearly as if physical fathoms were sought, she deliberately goes within. The pool is raised so I'm able to see Laura's vagina perfectly, and my eyes dart between hers and the true focal point of the action, and in this moment, the midwives seem like corner men in a prize fight, hanging back, knowing now that coaching and strategy are over and only nature remains. I can see the mound of the head, round and burgeoning behind the vagina, which is not yet open. Laura somehow manages to be completely primal and well-bred simultaneously, finding a voice I've never heard before, but still not swearing. There is but one moment of doubt amidst this giddying climax. I can't do it, she says to Marie, who responds again with the barely perceptible smile. Laura, no one in the history of mankind has not given birth after reaching this point. With this Gnostic promise received, Laura roars more. It is intense, and an aperture emerges, heralded by an unfurling flume of blood like a silent clarion call, and I see the head, a small circumference, a coin-sized revelation of the top of the baby's head. How can it all be surprising? How is it so amazing? I mean, this is what we are here for. Why then is it so amazing? More surges, more roars, more PG swearing. The vagina opens and I can see more head now. I am involved. Like a very late 89th minute penalty at Upton Park involved. Like life and death truly depended on football. Then, our arms locked, another push and 50% of a human head appears. It is beyond spectacular. So often spectacle is without substance. Another push, more roaring, both of us now, me effing and blinding and arming and Laura screaming, a life-affirming animal scream. An instrument to measure pulse is produced, the head is nearly out, the baby's heart has slowed, a few glances dart, but we are reassured, it's normal, says Marie. Then another push, and the whole head, for a moment just the head is out. Nature. This extraordinary and vivid sight, this strangeness, a head lolling below the surface, so peculiar but just nature. And then the final push, a scream, frozen clocks and stillness. The body emerges and moves not with independent motion but with the caress of the water. Once I tipped a dead goldfish down the toilet and was saddened by the resurrection the water granted. In water the fish rippled in elegant perfection, a momentary aquatic resurrection. The baby is moving only by the power of the water. The baby looks like an effigy of a baby, a doll, a special effects baby, a model. The motion is provided only by the water. All is so quiet and still. Laura and I both reach down and she takes her. It's a girl. The cord trails and tangles. Then, in her mother's arms, with searing and sudden certainty, as if touched by the finger of creation, her eyes flash open and life possesses her and exudes from her. Like seeing behind the curtain as she moves from life's shadow to life, how different is inanimate flesh to a living being. I watch the life flow in, and in this moment, when she came online, when her consciousness ignited, I felt new life enter me. I've heard new fathers say, I never knew such love was in me. But I always knew. I just didn't know what to do with it. When I saw her, I knew. I knew her, and I knew what to do. I climbed into the pool. Laura talks to her daughter.
Hello, I'm your mummy. I'm your mummy, and you've done so well.
She doesn't cry, but we do. Not sobbing or weeping. Tears run as if a newly acquired altitude is wringing them from our faces.